It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Orange and Brown Talk podcast, a Hey Mary Kay edition of the podcast. Dan Lobby here with Mary Kay Cabot. We are back from the Combine in Indianapolis, where we spent a couple days. Of course, we heard from Kevin Stefanski. We heard from Andrew Berry. And now we're sort of turning the page, Mary Kay, to free agency and what the Browns might do there. I want to start here because this kind of opens up a bigger discussion. The Browns did rework one contract last week, and that was Denzel Ward's. And of course, we'll sort of see what happens over the next few days here and the next week. But Mavro and Seabus wants to know, hey, Mary Kay, any news on who is close to reworking their contracts and how much more money do you feel they'd need to free up this year? And I'll also note here that Andrew was asked about Deshaun, and he did say they don't necessarily have to rework that contract, but then of course that doesn't mean that it won't happen at some point between now and even, I mean, sometime in the summer or before the season. So anything is on the table here.
Yes. Anything is on the table, but if they want to be active in the free agent market and the trade market, they need to clear some more cap space. What happened with Denzel's contract restructuring, in which they gained about $11.359 million, what happened there is the fact that it just put them slightly under the cap. So now they're probably $4 million under the cap. That's not enough to go out and sign your own free agents or other people's free agents. So they've got to get further under the cap. And one way they can possibly do that is to restructure Amari Cooper, who has a $24 million cap charge. They can also restructure Deshaun, as you mentioned. And they don't necessarily have to do it, but that's a perfect place to go when you need to restructure and gain some cap space. And it just makes sense to do it. You know you're giving him all that money anyways. Why not do it up front now? Get all the cap space that you need to accomplish your roster goals. So I fully expect it to happen. It's the easiest place to go. I mean, they know for sure that Deshaun will be open to it. Most players are open to it because really what happens for the people that don't really understand this is that you get an upfront restructure bonus. So they hand you $11 million and then it just it lowers your cap number. And sometimes they have to add a void year so that they can push some of that money out a little further. But for the most part, you're just getting an upfront chunk of money in the form of a bonus and you're lowering your base salary. So it's a win-win situation. Nobody minds doing it. And I think that Deshaun will probably have his redone pretty soon too.
Yeah, it's just, you know, it just means those direct deposits, those paydays during the season are a little smaller, but you're getting that money right now and instead of having to wait around for it. And it's a lot of money. So it's usually a good thing for the player. When we talk about how much cap space they have to clear, I think there's the free agency part of that. And I want to talk about that, but I also think we've seen how much Andrew Berry values rolling over cap space. You know, this team had the most cap space in the league at one point during the season last year. And that's sort of how they kind of create all this room, right? So you've got the rising salary cap, and then you're rolling over $20, $30 million from the previous year to add on to whatever the cap number is. And that's why they're able to kind of pay all these guys and have all these high price contracts. And so I think on top of being able to add players in free agency, I think over the course of the next however many months, you know, like I said, even into the season, Andrew's going to try to create as much cap space as he can to roll over so that next year, when we have to do this dance again, they're going to still be able to maintain a lot of that flexibility.
Yes, absolutely. And these guys are some of the best in the NFL at managing the cap. They have specific guys that do just that and really work very, very hard on that. And as we know, it's a front office filled with Ivy Leaguers, and they are some of the smartest in the business at managing this money. And they're very good at it. And I think they were actually almost at the forefront of doing all these restructures. It seemed to me that they were some of the first ones on the restructure bus in terms of lowering those caps, adding the voidable years, handing out those bonuses, and managing that enormous quarterback salary in that way. As we know, it's a $230 million guaranteed, fully guaranteed contract, $46 million a year, and Deshaun's cap number this year is about $64 million after all the restructurings and redos that he's done so far. So, you know, it's an easy place to look to grab $20 million if you need it.
So let's go ahead and turn the page to the next part of this discussion then. And obviously next week is going to be very interesting as teams sort of set up what they're going to do when that new league year starts off the week after. We might get some agreements, some trade agreements, whatever. What are you expecting from this football team in free agency? Are you expecting a big signing? Could it be a bunch of little signings? Are they happy with kind of where their roster's at? What do you think Andrew Berry's going to do in this free agency period?
You know, I think they head into it every year acting like they're not going to make a huge splash. And then they make a pretty big splash in free agency and trades. And I think it's smart. I mean, why not? If you have the money to do it and you can go out and you can find a receiver so that you don't have to rely on that number 54 pick in the second round to find your hopes and dreams at number two wideout, why not go ahead and do that? Why not try to sign a Calvin Ridley or trade for someone or sign a Gabe Davis or even a Mike Evans? I mean, that is probably the most unrealistic one in the bunch, but there are guys available. And I really do believe that they need to add one or two more formidable weapons to this offense. And I have to think that when Kevin Stefanski and Ken Dorsey meet next week in Los Angeles with Deshaun Watson, I think he's going to seriously make a pitch for at least one more Pro Bowl caliber receiver. Now, we have already heard him talk about T. Higgins, who was franchised by the Bengals. You can still acquire him in a trade, probably a lot more unrealistic now that he would land here on the Cleveland Browns doorstep. But I do think that they will look to sign a receiver, maybe not the most expensive receiver in free agency, but someone who can come in here and catch six or seven touchdown passes for you. Gabe Davis from the Buffalo Bills, he fits that profile. So does a Calvin Ridley. There are others in that category that I think that can do that. But they will also, once again, look to the trade market. That is how they acquired Amari Cooper. That is also how they acquired Elijah Moore. And some of Andrew Berry's best moves, as we know, have come via trade. So I think you can look to some of the other teams that might have a receiver that they're willing to part with to find one of those guys.
Yeah, I keep coming back to the trade market too, because I just wonder with the receivers that are out there and teams having money to spend, and it becoming such, teams are starting to understand you've got to have a guy. You've got to have a top tier receiver. You know, maybe you have Patrick Mahomes and it doesn't matter, but I mean, even Mahomes, you could use some more receivers there in Kansas City after what we saw from that offense this year. But like, most teams have got to have like a legitimate number one guy. And so I feel like some of these numbers we might see when free agency starts, they might just absolutely balloon. It's like when Christian Kirk got paid a ton of money a few years ago. And I like him. I think he's a good receiver, but he made way more than he should have made. But that's what the open market does. So that's why I keep coming back to this idea of, can you trade for a guy who maybe he would be expensive, but it's not going to cost you as much as having to go out and pay, you know, a Calvin Ridley, maybe more than you should pay a Calvin Ridley, and kind of put yourself in an uncomfortable spot there. So I don't know who it could be. I haven't really looked at some situations. I don't know if Mike Williams could be a guy or if that's even somebody they'd want with his injury history and his age, but like there's somebody out there is going to become available in a trade. It happens every year.
Yes, absolutely. And the Browns will find a way to pay that guy if they feel he's worth it. They are really, I would think, about one really good double-digit sack edge rusher and one 1,000 receiver, yard receiver away from being able to accomplish their goals this year, which of course is winning a Super Bowl. I think they need impact players at those two positions. I don't know if they would agree with me or not. Of course, Andrew Berry is never going to stand up at the podium and tell us, hey, we need this or we need that. But I think it's obvious. I think it's obvious that you need more weapons for Deshaun Watson. I mean, if you're going to make this kind of an investment in Deshaun, $230 million and 3 first-round picks, you need to supply him with as many weapons as possible so his job is easier. I mean, sure, you can go out and be a Patrick Mahomes and win a Super Bowl even without Tyreek Hill. But you aren't necessarily going to be that if you're anything other than Patrick Mahomes. You need weapons. So I think they will look to the trade market. Now, will Davante Adams be on the trading block? You know, he is somebody that certainly would be able to help get you over the top. And I'm sure somebody that the Browns would be intrigued by to a certain degree. But I don't know. I just don't know how much they're willing to spend from a draft capital standpoint. Now, when you look at Amari Cooper, they got him for a song. That was a 5th-round pick because basically the Cowboys were looking to unload his salary and they had, you know, that ship had sailed. That's what you need to find. And that's kind of the same thing that happened with Elijah Moore. The Jets were so ready to move on from him that, you know, they were just going to take anything. So I think that's the kind of player that you have to look for. Somebody that might be a little bit disgruntled, somebody who has worn out their welcome in a city and needs a change of scenery. Now, there are a number of guys that you wonder about. Will they get traded? Will they not? And we heard about some of those guys at the combine from some of the GMs. You know, Justin Jefferson is a receiver from the Vikings where they basically said, there's no way that we're parting with him. Davante Adams, same thing. But you never know. When push comes to shove and it's time to actually get very close to the league year opening, you usually see some unexpected deals happening.
And when we talk about free agency too, I just wanted to look up this contract here. So Dalvin Tomlinson signs that huge deal, 4 years, $57 million. You know, and obviously all these numbers come out right away and we see the headlines and we kind of get blown away by the numbers. But you know, Dalvin's cap hit last year was $4.3 million, and this year it's six and a half. And then next year it starts to get a little bigger. Then we start getting into double digits. He's got a void year in 2027 at age 33, where the cap number is $21 million. So that's the other thing. They could go out and sign a receiver to a number that when you see the headline or see the tweet, you're like, oh my God, they paid that much for that guy. But those first couple years on that cap, they might not need $20 million cap space. They're going to structure it in a way where they can fit, you know, it might be $6 or $7 million. They're going to mess around with that cap it a little bit. And that money's going to come due eventually, but you can spread it out. If the cap keeps going up, these dollars that you're spending now become even more valuable. Like they're not, a dollar now isn't going to be as expensive as it, you know, a dollar now is not going to be as expensive as it is a few years from now. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that right, but you understand inflation, yep. All this stuff I don't understand. But the cap is going to be more. So, you know, they can spend money. They can figure it out. They can still be aggressive, even if they don't have a ton of cap space.
Yeah, they can. And another place to look for money is, of course, the Nick Chubb contract. Nick Chubb has a $15.85 million cap charge for 2024. That is not going to remain like that. One way or the other, he will have one of those very low base salaries of about $1.2 million. No matter how you slice it, that's what that will probably end up being. So that's another place where you can gain maybe $10, $11 million in cap space. So there are places to find it, and it's just a matter of what becomes available and what the price tags are. And nobody really knows for sure yet. Another area that I mentioned that they will look at in free agency will be edge rushers, because their number two edge rusher, Za'Darius Smith, is going to test the free agent market, as I wrote last week. He's going to test the market and he might find a new home. He might find someone who's willing to pay him even more than the Browns are. I think they would like to pay him about what he got last year, which is in the $11 million range, maybe a little more than that. Some of these other guys are going to be getting $15, $16, $17 million. So they're going to have to see what they can do there. There are some good pass rushers available or that should be available. And we don't even know the answer to that yet because teams can franchise or transition tag their guys until March 5th and then, you know, re-up, renegotiate with them and sign them to extensions. So no one is really exactly sure who's going to hit the market yet. But I think that's one place to look. I really do. I think it's a place where they're going to have to determine if Z is coming back or if they have to look elsewhere. Now, I know he wants to be back here, and I know they really want him back here. He's a good candidate to return, but that's one to keep an eye on.
Okay, let's take a break here, and then we've got a few more questions we want to get to, including one about one of the position coaches that remained in the coaching shakeup. And welcome back to the Orange and Brown Talk podcast. Dan Lobby, Mary Kay Cabot, a Hey Mary Kay edition of the podcast. Fred from Naples has a question about Chad O'Shea. He says, Hey Mary Kay, Chad O'Shea is the only offensive position coach to return from last year. I can't think of a player he's developed since he's been with the Browns. Tillman looked lost when he was out there last year. What do you think of O'Shea? And I've heard this sentiment expressed on social media, the receiver room under O'Shea and how did he end up being the one guy they kept? So why do you think O'Shea kind of was that one guy that stuck around?
Well, first of all, I think Chad O'Shea is an excellent receiver coach. I really do. And even though it might seem like guys were lost or whatever, when you're talking about a third round pick going out and playing high level football in the NFL, you know, it's remarkable to get those guys on the field. It really is. It's not something where you can just step in and excel like you can if you were a number one pick or a first round pick from Alabama or another SEC team. When you get down into the third round, you're not talking about someone who's supposed to be NFL ready. So just getting them out there and having them function and get their feet wet in the NFL is vitally important. I think the upside is good for Cedric Tillman. He's got the size. He's got the strong hands. He's got a lot of things going for him. As far as Elijah Moore is concerned, I think Elijah suffered from the revolving door at quarterback last season. He was brought in here to match up really nicely with Deshaun Watson. It didn't go that way. He had to work with four different starting quarterbacks, and I think he suffered from that a little bit. One area where I think they really need to mine things for Elijah Moore is in the red zone and the end zone. He needs to be catching more touchdown passes and scoring the football more. A lot of them do. So, you know, that's one area to look at there. As far as Chad is concerned, though, you know, I think he's a really, really good receivers coach. And he's very close to Kevin Stefanski. I know that there's no way Kevin would have wanted to part with him. And I think it's important to maintain at least some continuity on that offensive coaching staff. You know, maybe Amari wouldn't be the player that he is without Chad right now. And when you look back over his history in New England and all the receivers that he has coached to Pro Bowls and very, very high level play, I think his track record speaks for itself.
Yeah. And, you know, I've heard other receivers who have played for him, you know, say good things about him. You know, I heard an interview with Julian Edelman once who just raved about O'Shea. And it's some of the things like you understand why Kevin loves having him around. He's a veteran guy and his receivers are going to block and they're going to, you know, they're going to be active in the run game. And that's all the stuff that the Browns want these guys to do. I would point to Donovan Peoples-Jones as a guy that he did a good job with. Obviously, that he kind of hit a ceiling eventually, and the Browns moved on. But that was a sixth-round pick that you got, you know, some productive seasons out of, a guy that made some big catches for you. I think that's a guy I would point to. And some of it, too, is like you can't just turn everybody into a great NFL player. If I showed up, it doesn't matter how good of a coach you are. You're not going to turn me into an NFL receiver. You know, it's impossible. It's not going to happen. And there's just some guys that maybe it's not the position coach. Maybe the front office missed on a pick, or maybe the guy just isn't the player they thought he would be. Maybe the guy didn't put in the work. I'm not saying that part about any of these guys, but like there's so many factors that go into a guy developing into an NFL player. You know, I don't know. I mean, it's, some of it comes down to what, like a guy like David Bell, what are your actual expectations for him to be in the league? He's never going to be a 1,000-yard receiver. So, you know, a position coach can only do so much.
Right. And when you look at it, Chad O'Shea has not been supplied with any first-round receivers since he's been here or any second-round receivers since he's been here. He's had to try to get Anthony Schwartz ready to play and David Bell, third-rounder, ready to play. Cedric Tillman, third-rounder, ready to play. So it's not like he's had Justin Jefferson and, geez, it's just not working out all that well. So I think he's done a really nice job. You mentioned Donovan Peoples-Jones, sixth round receiver, and he got him out there playing well enough to the point where they were able to get a draft pick back in return for him. And I think Chad has done a really nice job with what he's had to work with.
Okay, one of the big stories to come out of this week, I feel like we've become a travel podcast, but look, it's something Browns fans are they want to know. It affects them too in a lot of ways, whether it's, you know, a couple weeks away from Berea where they can't go to training camp, or a game that's going to be potentially in Brazil instead of Philadelphia, which is a very drivable trip for Browns fans if they wanted to go to it. Terry Cosma in Strongsville has this question. Hey, Mary Kay, the Browns are talking about playing in Rio, and it seems like that's something they want to do, and adding another exhibition game, which you included in one of your stories that you put up from the Combine. So Terry's question is, why extend a long season with extra travel and another meaningless exhibition game? All the injuries the Browns had last year, seems like adding extra travel and games is crazy.
Well, I actually tend to agree with our texter here. I think that it's a lot. I think the Brazil trip to start the season can be very taxing on a team. We'll have to see how it goes. But I think they're looking back to 2023, and this team spent a lot of time on the road. They started out at the Greenbrier for 10 days. They spent a week in Philadelphia. They spent a week in Los Angeles, and they ended up in the playoffs with four different quarterbacks. So I think they want to recreate some of the magic that happened in 2023, despite the fact that they had the Hall of Fame game, despite the fact that they had all of these trips that they went on. So I think that they feel really good about the way that they travel. I don't know that you need a fourth exhibition game and that you need to get that Hall of Fame game in. But I will say this, they had so many young guys playing in that game. They did not play their veterans in that game. They did not. It was really an opportunity for them to see what Dorian Thompson-Robinson could do, what Juwan Jones could do, and they got a lot out of it. They felt that they really benefited. It was an evaluation process for all the back end guys on the roster, all the rookies, all the young guys. So that's why they would like to do it again. And it also gives them the opportunity to start camp a week early and to get a jump on everyone. So I think they really want to have it. And I would have to say that there's probably a good chance that the league will give it to them. There's not that many teams clamoring for the Hall of Fame game. I mean, if you're going to raise your hand and ask for it, you're probably going to get it. They only have to drive right down the road to go play in that game. So we'll see how that goes. As far as Brazil is concerned, they really want that too. And not a lot of other teams would really want to go to Brazil. That's going to be at least a 12-hour flight, I would think, if you're going directly from Cleveland on, you know, that's for the Browns themselves, a 12-hour flight. Now, for us, Dan, when we try to fly down to Brazil, it's probably going to be more like 17 hours because we're going to have to stop somewhere. But
I'll throw out a tip for anybody who's thinking about this. I was told over this week, go through Miami or don't go through like Houston or something like that. Go make sure you go through like Miami or someplace like that. But anyway. That's for another pod. I don't know. I guess it's faster.
Okay.
But
good to know.
I don't know.
Very good to know.
But if I'm wrong, don't hold me to that.
But, you know, you just have to wonder, what if they didn't make the playoffs this year? What if Jake Moody sails that kick through at the end of the 49ers game? Do they still want the Hall of Fame game? Do they still want to go to Brazil? You know, do they still want to spend 10 days at the Greenbrier? There's such a razor-thin margin between success and failure, or playoffs and no playoffs. And it's just kind of interesting to see that they want to do some of the same things they did last year because it resulted in the playoffs.
Okay. I'm going to throw out a random conspiracy theory, not random, a conspiracy theory I just thought of. So if they do what they did last year and they get to start a week early, they would condense the off-season program, right? So they would knock off a likely like they did last year. So they'd knock off a week of OTAs and hold mini camp a week earlier. But they'd replace that week of OTAs, which are not mandatory, with a mandatory week of training camp. So essentially, you're replacing an optional week of the off-season program with a mandatory training camp week. Now, I don't know if that's what's running through Kevin's head, but there's a part of me kind of wonders, like, this team has had generally pretty good attendance at OTAs, but not 100% attendance. Maybe if you take away an optional week and another week where players have to be there, there's probably some benefit to that.
Oh, absolutely. There's benefit to that. Now, by the time you get to the end of OTAs, most guys are there. Most guys are showing up, but you're right. This is a mandatory week of training camp. And I would have to think that the players are not going to love having to end their summer on July 20th. I am not sure players are going to be really overly excited about that. And they
players aren't going to love it.
Right? Don't get me started, Dan. But it's going to be interesting because they all talked a really great game about being at the Greenbrier for 10 days. But, you know, is it going to be the same the second time around? I don't know. I mean, there are other teams that, you know, the Dallas Cowboys hold training camp out in California. So going away, going off site for training camp is not unheard of by any stretch of the imagination, but we'll just have to see how this all goes. Like I said, it resulted in a playoff berth last year, the way they did everything, because of the bonding that they talked about. I don't know if you can recreate it, but they certainly hope to try.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. And I think one of the things that stood out to me is, as we went through last year, it felt like the LA trip ended up being a little bit of a bridge too far. Now, that helped a lot with Joe Flacco coming in. I know he kind of took advantage of it. He went to some dinners and stuff and did some things that kind of endeared him to his teammates. But I've got to say, and part of it is because it was a losing locker room, but it just seemed like guys were tired after that trip. That trip didn't seem to have quite the sizzle that some of the other ones had. And it just felt like in that locker room and hearing guys talk about, God, they just felt a little bit tired after that one, which I don't blame. I mean, I was tired after that trip. So that one felt like it was maybe just a little too far. It obviously wasn't anything that derailed the season because they turned around and won a bunch of games and made the playoffs. But I do think the Greenbrier had a positive effect. We'll see if they can replicate that. I think it's going to be harder, but I don't blame them for trying.
No, I mean, as you mentioned, I mean, that LA trip that was back-to-back losses, and that was tough. That was a little period in the season where you really wondered, is this going to turn out the way they hope that it will? And who knew at that time that Joe Flacco was about to embark on four straight victories with 300 yards passing in each of them? No one could have foreseen that at that time. So, yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how this goes because I think that they will get the Hall of Fame game. We already know that they're going to the Greenbrier. We know that they're hosting the Minnesota Vikings for joint practices. At least they don't have to go there because there was some thought that it was going to be in Minnesota. And I think they have a really good chance of getting the Brazil game. I was told through some people at the NFL Combine that it's really kind of down to the Packers and the Browns. Those are the two likeliest candidates to go to Brazil. And of course, if the Browns don't go to Brazil, there is still a chance that they could go to London and face the Jaguars there. So it's going to be a season of heavy travel again.
Well, we got my passport ready to go from the last time they went to London, which I was not sent to, but I did get my passport in order. So I'm ready. Let's go. Let's do this. Let's see the world. Okay, one more question here. This is sort of a random history question, but it comes from Eric in Middletown. Hey, Mary Kay, would you rate Bernie Kosar as the greatest quarterback in Browns history?
Well, it's a good question.
I think I know who. I mean, I would say no, but I he's in the discussion.
He's in the discussion. And you've got Otto Graham that you have to.
Yeah, that would probably be my choice.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to put Otto Graham first, I would think. And then, you know, then you've got Bernie and Brian Sipe. And yeah,
It's not a long list.
Definitely not a long list.
You don't have to go very far before you get to like Brian Hoyer, which says a lot. By the way, speaking of that, and I hate to give Johnny Manziel any more attention. What did you think of that whole kind of dust up last week with Johnny and Brian? I thought it was a little unfair to Brian.
It was so unfair to Brian. So many years have passed. And why is Johnny out there right now throwing shade at Brian Hoyer? That is so ridiculous. First of all, Brian Hoyer is a Cleveland native. Why are you going to do that? How are you going to win that battle in the court of public opinion? And then we all know that Johnny was a train wreck when he was here in Cleveland. And Brian was trying to get this team to the playoffs and had a really nice record and was playing really well before, I think, got so rattled by knowing that the front office and some coaches wanted Johnny in there when Brian was out there trying to get the job done. Why would you do that to Brian? I don't think he won over too many people with that little tirade. And I just don't think it was necessary. And I just think that every time he needs some attention, he goes to the, I didn't do what I was supposed to do in Cleveland well. And it's tired and it's worn out. And quite frankly, I am very disappointed in the way that he did waste a couple of Joe Thomas's seasons and the good seasons of other Browns players. So I've heard enough of those years. I knew he was a train wreck when he showed up on the Browns doorstep, and it just never got any better. It was a dark period in Cleveland Browns history, and he needs to leave it there.
And like it wasn't Brian Hoyer's job to help Johnny Manziel take his job. Yeah, I mean, that was the opportunity Hoyer had been waiting for to finally start. Like, you know, and he had kind of gotten an opportunity the year before. And, you know, certainly you want to be a good teammate and you want to help a young guy out. But, like, it's not his job to, like, set Johnny up to eventually take his job. This is a competitive business. You know, these guys are out there competing. And so I don't put anything on Brian Hoyer. And publicly, if I remember right, Brian was always, he always played nice. He didn't do like the Ryan Tannehill thing when the Titans drafted, I'm blanking on his name all of a sudden, but when the Titans drafted eventually a guy that might replace him, he kind of came out and said, maybe he wouldn't help him. That's mm-hmm. maybe going a little too far, but like, this is a competitive business. When you have an opportunity to start, and you have a knucklehead who's not paying attention and has to keep getting things repeated to him, what are you supposed to do? You know, it's not his job to help Johnny take his job.
No. And in addition to that, as you mentioned, Johnny was a knucklehead. It was evident that he was not in his playbook. He was asking questions that he shouldn't have had to be asking. It's very obvious when you're not studying, when you're not working, when you have no work ethic, and that you probably have a substance abuse issue that is pretty evident to everyone around you, and that you just don't belong there. So why should Brian Hoyer have gone out of his way to help someone in that situation who wasn't willing to help himself? And I just think that Johnny was way out of line for calling Brian out like that.
Yeah, and like the McCown thing the next year was different because Josh was older. He was just in a different spot than Brian Hoyer was. Again, that was Brian Hoyer's, and it turned out to really kind of be his only opportunity. So that was a moment. Like, he needed to try and take advantage of that. His hometown team, he's the starting quarterback. You start the year 7-4. Obviously, it didn't work out. But, I can't blame him for that at all. So there we go. A little Johnny Brian Hoyer talk to wrap up this edition of the Orange and Brown Talk podcast. Our questions came from our Football Insider subscribers. It's cleveland.com/Browns, the blue banner at the top of the page to sign up for that and become one of our texters as well, so you can submit questions for the Hey Mary Kay edition of the podcast. Find us on Instagram, search Orange and Brown Talk, and on YouTube, search Cleveland Browns on cleveland.com. And of course, make sure you're subscribed to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Leave us nice reviews. We always like to see those. Mary Kay, I will talk to you later.
Sounds great.